Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Christine Sandy, and I'm the Program Director for the Rural Health Information Hub. And I'd like to welcome you to today's webinar, where we'll be talking about building local level partnerships for rural emergency preparedness. I have just a few housekeeping items to run through before we begin. First, we've provided a PDF copy of the presentation in the RHI Hub website, and that's accessible through the URL that's on your screen. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our speakers for today's webinar. Our first speaker is Megan Melnick, and Megan is a senior research associate at the Norg Walsh Center for Rural Health Analysis. She is a qualitative and mixed methods researcher in the areas of public health systems, environmental health, and public health emergency preparedness, among other public health topics. Her work focuses on advancing the evidence base around public health practice and rural community health programs. Next is Margaret Staub, and she has served for 6 years as the Healthcare Readiness and Response Coordinator for the Region 5 Bighorn Basin Healthcare Coalition. Wyoming's healthcare preparedness program enhances community and healthcare preparedness, improves medical surge capacity, and supports healthcare organizations during emergency response and recovery through 5 regional healthcare coalitions around the state. Deputy Chief Mike Moore is a 23-year member of the fire service with a passion for inspiring fire service leadership, incident command, fire ground strategy, and tactics and training program development. He currently serves as the Chief Training Officer for Southern Stone County Fire Protection District in Southwest Missouri, a combination department that covers 280 square miles in Southwest Missouri, which responds to over 3,000 calls per year. Diane Connery has been committed to rural public libraries since 2010. She is actively invested in efforts to improve digital inclusion in rural communities. She is passionate about inspiring others and advocating for the work of rural libraries with an emphasis on community resilience. The Pottsboro Library was named one of the top 3 best small libraries in America in 2017. Ms. Connery was honored as an Innovator in Library Journal's Movers and Shakers Class of 2021, and she was selected as the 2022 Texas Small Community Librarian of the Year. And with that, I'll turn it over to Megan.
Hello, everyone. My name is Megan Melnick, and as Christine said, I'm a senior research associate at NORC at the University of Chicago. And today, I'm happy to introduce the Rural Emergency Preparedness and Response Toolkit. The toolkit was produced by the NORC Walsh Center for Rural Health Analysis and the Rural Health Information Hub. This toolkit is a resource designed to support and strengthen rural preparedness and response programs. The NORC Walsh Center is part of the Public Health Research Department at NORC at the University of Chicago, where we conduct policy analyses, research, and evaluations to address the needs of rural communities. RHI Hub is a national clearinghouse on rural health issues and supports healthcare and population health. Their website offers an online library of resources like topic guides, podcasts, and the toolkit that we'll discuss today. The Rural Emergency Preparedness and Response Toolkit provides information and resources for rural communities implementing emergency planning, response, and recovery efforts. It was developed to help rural and tribal communities, healthcare facilities, and other organizations serving rural populations by providing access to evidence-based and promising models and resources to support them in preparedness and response. A key focus of our work has been to establish a rural evidence base. Evidence-based toolkits are an important step in disseminating successful programs and strategies. And this toolkit is unique because it combines evidence, expert advice, and the actual experiences of rural communities into one easy-to-use resource to support successful rural health programs. The toolkit is available at ruralhealthinfo.org/toolkits/emergency preparedness. It's comprised of 6 modules, and each module focuses on different considerations for rural preparedness and response programs. The modules address the steps in emergency planning, response, and recovery, cross-cutting issues and key considerations, the types of public health emergencies and disasters for which rural communities may need to respond, methods for considering for assessing the impact of the emergency or disaster, and funding, resources, and support. There's also a set of 31 case studies with insights from rural leaders and organizations who have faced many different types of disasters and many different rural settings. You'll find guidance on and examples of partners and collaboration throughout the toolkit. For example, in Module 1, it introduces rural emergency preparedness and response. It includes definitions and unique considerations for rural communities, It also includes information on collaborating with partners. So let's talk a little bit more about that. One of the things we talk about in the toolkit is that it's important to maintain a base of partners to grow, expand, and engage in all emergency activities. These relationships should stay active even when not responding to an emergency. This can be achieved by formalizing partnerships like MOUs, for example. But when creating partnerships, rural communities should look beyond organizations only focused on health and safety. Partners may be at the local, state, and national level, and we'll hear more about the different types of partners from our speakers. Partnerships are a great resource during an emergency, but it's also important to engage partners at each step. So including partners in the planning process to conduct needs assessments, determine strategies and activities, and define roles for those activities are great ways to involve partners initially. In the response phase, be sure to communicate with your network and recruit the necessary resources to coordinate and deliver response activities. When moving to the recovery phase, identify community needs and connect them with resources, assess the response to your partners, and disseminate what you've learned. So this was just some of the information available in the Rural Emergency Preparedness and Response Toolkit. Be sure to visit ruralhealthinfo.org to learn more. And I'll turn it over to our first speaker. Thank you.
All right. The Bighorn Basin Healthcare Coalition wrote their charter in 2014, and we became a 501c3 last year. Our funding is through the Hospital Preparedness Grant, which is a federal grant that's written and administered by the state of Wyoming, but all five healthcare coalitions have become 501c3s. We are local administrators of a federal grant that's written by the state, kind of confusing. And our coalition covers four counties in rural frontier northwest Wyoming. Our borders are Montana, Yellowstone National Park, and the Wind River Indian Reservation. This map shows the region. It's outlined in red. As you can see, it's pretty darn big. We do have some challenges. Our area is larger than the states of Massachusetts and Connecticut combined. And we have a population of fewer than 55,000 people, except in the summer when it swells because of tourists. Our population density is 3.8 people per square mile. And a lot of that land, like 80% or 70%, I forget the statistic, is federally owned. We're surrounded by a ring of mountains with a high desert, stunning rock formations, rivers, creeks, and streams. It's a huge area with a very sparse population. And so coordinating healthcare delivery brings special challenges to the coalition. Just imagine, you know, getting an ambulance up to a mountain pass that is covered with snow. Anyway, there's a picture of skiing at our local mountain. That's actually my son. So we have a lot of things to consider, including working with federal entities. It's not something that we do in our coalition on a regular basis, but the partnership, they're not written partnership agreements, but we know the people who to contact and everybody steps up to the plate in emergency. That's what, you know, collaboration and cooperation are all about. We are actually, I didn't write this down, but working on getting MOUs signed with a variety of entities, organizations in our four county area in case of an emergency response situation, primarily for transportation and for sheltering if needed. Neither one of those is probably going to be needed, but we want everything in place just in case it is. Anyway, we share a border with it. Wind River Indian Reservation, it's largely in central coalition, but we do also have some reservation land in our catchment area. And that means also coordinating with the BIA. And annually, we do what's called an HVA, which is a risk assessment, to identify what risks are most likely to have an impact on a healthcare facility in the surrounding community. The coalition combines them from our six hospitals and does a coalition HVA and some environmental examples of Hazardous vulnerabilities include flooding, especially in Hot Springs County because of the Poison Dam and the location of the healthcare facilities in Thermopolis, Wyoming. Wildland fires are always a huge concern. Not only the risk of evacuation, but also the risk of smoke inhalation and burns, of course. Potential earthquakes, tornadoes, severe winter weather is a huge concern, which is why we invest heavily in generators, not the coalition itself, but emergency management primarily. And other vulnerabilities include physical vulnerability, economic vulnerability, and social vulnerability. Oh, that's just a picture of a wildland fire up in the mountains. They happen with monotonous regularity. And the Wyoming Army National Guard UHS-60 Blackhawk helicopter takes off from Laramie Regional Airport in Wyoming to assist in fighting the Keystone Fire July 6th in 2017. Visible at left is the helicopter's water bucket. The National Guard helps with firefighting. The National Guard also, if requested by emergency management, the governor of the state of Wyoming will step in and assist with response situations. During the pandemic, they assisted local healthcare facilities with some staffing needs. We're having a big exercise June 14th, and the National Guard is actually putting it on, the Vigilant Guard. And they're flying a Black Hawk helicopters up to Powell, Wyoming, to help deal with an exercise scenario that involves radiation and an active shooter. We're all quite excited about it. It will be a regional response for our entire coalition. So this is just a list of all of our current members. We're always looking to, increase our membership and increase our partnerships and collaboration with additional healthcare providers and emergency responders in the four county region. And we had a ice jam event in March in a town about 10 miles from where I live. When the mountains thaw and the snow melts and the rivers flow high, the ice breaks up and we have ice jams frequently, almost every year in some locations. Anyway, this tells about the response situation. The healthcare coalition was not involved in this. This was an emergency response. It's just an example of, an environmental hazard that can happen. And the level of response that we have in our communities at a moment's notice, thank goodness, neighbors help neighbors. We have to help neighbors. Help's not coming from anywhere else. We're too isolated. We're too far away. Cheyenne's in the opposite corner of the state. So it would take them 5 hours to get anybody here from Cheyenne, which is the state capital of Wyoming. Rural partnership. Our goal is to actively engage stakeholders in our local hospital preparedness program, which is, HPP. And in our healthcare coalition, which is HCC, which is confusing. And key stakeholders include fire, emergency medical services, which is, ambulances, law enforcement, school districts, as well as the full spectrum of healthcare providers. When we have full-scale exercises, we had one last June in Lovell, Wyoming, involving WBI, which is a energy producing, gas producing local business. They participated and let us use their property as the staging area. Anyway, when we have full scale exercises, lots of people use that for their exercise for their organization and they participate, including dispatch, law enforcement, fire and search and rescue, and local industries. We have really good turnout. Last year, we had about 80 people altogether, including the local hospital, which had a big presence, North Bighorn Hospital in Lovell, participate, which was unheard of. And it all went very smoothly. And of course, we learn things we need to learn about, and that's the purpose of an exercise. We'd rather learn about them during an exercise than an annual event. And this is just an example of a different picture of Wyoming than our mountains, and tells why it's called Red Canyon. It's not actually in our coalition, but we have areas like this in our coalition. I just like this picture of the woman and her dog standing on the red rocks. So we have lots and lots of established relationships. This tells about the National Guard active shooter exercise and radiation spill. And I'm going to start reading here. We are focusing on linking disparate networks together so as to focus their attention on improving health security capabilities, law enforcement, the college, Northwest Community College in Powell, Wyoming. Search and rescue, fire, emergency management services, EMS, ambulances, public health, and hospitals will all be involved. And what the coalition does currently under the capabilities that are required now by the federal grant is assist with coordinating the acquisition and distribution of needed supplies and supporting coordinated response and unified command across sectors. We use the NIMS or the HICS uniformly, depending on the situation. We provide a lot of training to build workforce capacity and resilience and to increase the capability and readiness and response abilities of our healthcare partners. Training includes national incident management training, stop the bleed, active shooter, decontamination, advanced burn life support, and more. Our exercises are designed to test our annexes and increase our ability to respond quickly to a medical search incident. The state of Wyoming and our healthcare coalition are also involved in the Regional Disaster Coalition and participated in a tabletop exercise last August with them. Our coalition, during the pandemic, decided we needed a cache of PPE and decon supplies. Protective gear was purchased with federal funding. During the pandemic, ventilators were needed at the hospitals. We also invested in radios for communication. Getting in supplies such as gloves, masks, and booties was a challenge during the height of the pandemic. If you haven't seen it, this is hazmat gear needed, you know, during a chemical spill event at the railroad, for example, also a radiation event at the college. It's needed for a number of things. We have a lot of oil and gas producers here. And, you know, sometimes there's accidents out in the oil field. The more prepared we are as an organization, the better equipped we'll be to support our communities when responding to an emergency. A lack of understanding of organizational and community preparedness may culminate in undue stress and exhaustion during times of emergencies, but also in anticipation of future emergencies. Normalizing a culture of preparedness and utilizing key response concepts outside of an emergency provides an opportunity to educate and empower staff while bringing value to the goal at hand. There we go. I must be done.
Good morning. Good afternoon. My name is Mike Moore. I serve as the Deputy Fire Chief for Southern Stone County Fire. We're located in the southwest portion of Missouri. We are a heavy tourist area. And so July the 19th this year will mark our fifth year remembrance of the duck boat incident that occurred on Table Rock Lake, which shares three counties and a number of different jurisdictions. And we'll talk a little bit more about the cooperative efforts during this mass casualty incident. So to kind of give you a little bit of a background, the duck boats had been quite a staple in the Branson area. Tourists would be able to get on to this kind of an amphibious vehicle It gets its term duck from the World War II era D-U-K-W. And so they just kind of took the duck part. But what it was an amphibious vehicle that could go on land and as well in water. So tourists would come and the duck boat would drive them around Branson, and they could see some of the highlights, some of the different things that are in Branson. And then it would go over the Table Rock Dam. And then there would be a ramp that the duck would go down the ramp, splash in, and kind of go around the lake, around the Branson Bell, which is a kind of a mock-up of a steamboat. And they do shows on the Branson Bell quite frequently during the summertime. So on this particular day, there were a number of duck boats who were carrying tourists throughout Branson and into Table Rock Lake. And we had some very serious storms, squalls that came through, which isn't necessarily unusual, but this one in particular was almost of a radical nature. It was unlike anything that we'd really seen in this area with this type of a squall, where we were actually seeing very high waves out in the lake. Table Rock Lake is a Army Corps of Engineer lake created by Table Rock Dam. And so at that particular point, there were two ducks that were out in Table Rock Lake. And when this squall came in, there were also passengers on the Branson Bell. And if you type in duck boat incident Branson into a YouTube video search, there is actual video of passengers on the showboat that were taken of the duck boats. One was kind of struggling and the other one was trying to get through that squall. And obviously one was able to make it to the shore and the other one did not. There were 31 individuals on this particular duck that sank. Of those 31 individuals, 17 individuals perished. This happened pretty close to about 7 o'clock in the evening when we were given the dispatch of a duck that had sank. We proceeded obviously toward the scene, and our duty officer of the day had immediately declared a mass casualty just simply based on the fact that this was probably going to be 20 to 30 individuals in the water, in the storm. So we announced a mass casualty incident right away. One of the things that I guess, and I've mentioned this before, is when I arrived on scene near the berth of the Branson Bell, one of the things that caught my attention very quickly was the personal flotation devices. They were like a bright red, and there were a number of those in the berthing area around the Branson Bell. And I was, I thought, wow, that's a lot of people in the water. And as I kind of got a little closer to the situation, I noticed that many of those life vests, they were just floating. There was nobody there. If you take a Google map and you look at where the Dewey Short Center for the Army Corps of Engineers, they have a kind of a visitor center there. There's a peninsula that comes off of where Table Rock Dam is. And then the Dewey Short Center and the Branson Bell are all on this peninsula. Well, the boundaries for Stone County were set up before before the dam was built. And so consequently, this little peninsula is still in Stone County, although it's kind of a ways out of our jurisdiction, but it's still in Stone County. So you have Taney County, which is where Branson is. Branson has their own fire department. There's Western Taney County Fire Protection District that also covers the kind of the area around that peninsula. And then Southern Stone County Fire Protection District, where we cover 280 square miles of Stone County. We go down to the Arkansas border. Table Rock Dam is very big. And so there's a lot of different jurisdictions that cover it. And so this, even in this little particular situation, geographically, it covered Western Taney Fire Protection District. Branson Fire Rescue was also involved in that, Southern Stone County Fire. We have two different EMS agencies. So there's Taney County Ambulance District, as well as Mercy EMS, which is a part of Mercy Healthcare Systems. So we had a number of different, and of course, Stone County Sheriffs, Taney County Sheriffs. So we had a lot of different emergency agencies that were involved in this mass casualty incident. So when we talk about cooperative work and cooperative effort between these different emergency services, anybody in the audience who is familiar with how well law enforcement and EMS and fire service folks, it can be a struggle to make that work. When you take those agencies that may work together some of the time, and you put them in this kind of a mass casualty incident, it can be very daunting. It can be a very difficult task of bringing all these disciplines together and making them work. Excuse me. But with that being said, we all understood that there was obviously an incident that we knew was going to affect our area for an extended period of time. One of the things that was a difficulty was communications, because we had different agencies using different frequencies of communication. Some people had VHF radios, some people were working off UHF radios, and also off of a digital system, or MOSWIN, which is what's used in the state of Missouri for digital communication. So we had a communication issue where we had to actually designate folks in the incident command system. In the incident command post, we had a unified command. So we had a representative, obviously, with Southern Stone. We had a representative from Western Taney. We had our medical branch was with TCAD and Mercy. So they were able to communicate with their units without us having to worry about checking on a number of frequencies. So that made it very easy. One of the things that we also found out was that accountability was almost impossible. It was nearly impossible for any accountability to be had, because you had so many different agencies coming in, and you had so many different apparatus coming in, personnel coming in. Accountability was very tricky. excuse me. Once we established the operations branch, I was the operations branch along with a battalion chief from Western Taney. We got onto the Branson Bell. We had three cardiac arrests that were being tended to by civilians. We had obviously the Branson Bell itself had a number of individuals, civilians, who were participating in active rescues of trying to get people out of the water. And that could have potentially been a disaster in and of itself. But fortunately, we were able to get folks out of the water, try to resuscitate them, And those outcomes were not good. But it was very difficult for us initially to determine who was a part of the Branson Bell and who was not. So that kind of accountability can be very difficult. The bottom line really for us was that we knew that the first few minutes were just going to be catastrophic. They were going to be chaotic. And so we had some wonderful responders who were able to step up into those different roles that we asked them to perform from different agencies, and they were able to work together. We understood also that this was of a national news situation. We were receiving phone calls from national news agencies. I had no idea how they were getting a hold of my phone number, other agency leadership phone numbers. They were receiving phone calls from the media. So we had to work together on how we were going to be transparent with the information or what we were doing as agencies, and making sure that we were doing the right thing. And sometimes that can be very difficult when you're dealing with different agencies and different leaderships in different agencies. They might have a different view of the media. They may have a different view of how agencies work together. Just to kind of finish up a little bit, I would say that there are a couple of things that I would cooperatively emphasize. One is lessons learned versus lessons identified. We identified a lot of things. We identified a lot of gaps. We identified a lot of communication issues. So we identified them, but that's not necessarily, we haven't necessarily come even after 5 years later. There are some things that we're still learning. So there's lessons identified cooperatively versus lessons learned. And second, I would say that I'm very proud of how we were as a community able to come together and be able to demonstrate, I think, as the previous speaker, our motto is neighbors helping neighbors. And so we have a lot of tourists that come in, and we want to treat them like neighbors, and we want to treat them with respect. So cooperatively using the incident command system was also imperative.
All right. Thanks, Mike. And we'll get Diane's slides up here and turn it over to you, Diane.
So I am coming to you from the Pottsboro Library in Pottsboro, Texas. We're about 90 miles north of Dallas, a rural town, 2,600 people. And on the border with Oklahoma, there's a big lake recreation area near us. So I'll be talking about our emergency response to the big freeze that we had in February of 2021. And I did want to mention whatever view or image you have of a library in your mind, forget that, because that's really not what we do. We're not a traditional library. In a rural community, I suspect, like many of yours, that there are not a lot of social services, other kind of government services available. So the library becomes the community hub. And if you have not had the opportunity to partner with your local library, I hope you will consider it. So we're kind of on our own, as the earlier speakers mentioned. We have to, when disaster strikes, take care of ourselves until first responders can get here. And a library's role from the beginning was connecting people to information they need. And in a small town, there are limited methods or pathways of communication. We don't have a newspaper. We don't have a TV station. there's a lot of people who don't have access to the internet. So much of our information is passed just word of mouth, over the phone, that kind of thing. And then also keeping in mind when a disaster strikes, a small town has limited capacity to respond to it. So in our case, if there is a broken water pipe, the city manager is literally out with a shovel digging holes to get things repaired. So I'll talk about the freeze we had and the role we played. So in Texas, we have our own power grid. And the power grid shut down for up to 7 days for many people throughout Texas. And in our case, the water system shut down as well, which I had never even really considered as being possible. But it shut down as well. So there was a little snow on the ground, but not a lot of snow. Early on, the recommendation was go out and shovel snow to be able to flush your toilets. So as a library, we connected with ranchers and people who had wells outside of town and had them use their trucks to bring it into the library. And then people who could get to the library, bring whatever kind of container they had to come pick up water. And we had water that was safe for drinking and then water that was just to be used for flushing. And then we had some of those ranchers go around town because water is heavy to carry and knocked on doors like, do you need water? And so distribute it in that way. Then when the TV stations were up and running, we had them share information for us. And we've got them on speed dial, which is a really nice thing about a rural community. They're always looking for news and positive news, especially. So they were able to help us get the word out. One local restaurant, because their power was out, their food was in danger of going bad. So they offered to cook the food that they had, prepare hot meals if we could bring them well water, which we did. And so then we brought that food back to the library and distributed those meals. So it really was about people wanting to help each other, reaching out to their neighbors who they knew might be in bad shape. We had volunteers coming to the library to get water to distribute. In one case, there was a woman who was homebound and was almost bedridden, and she could not get to her toilet. She was not able to put water in her toilet tank to flush. And at some point that starts to become a health issue. So we had volunteers who were willing to like go into her home and fill up toilet tanks. So just good people. Slide, please. So we did, trying to make light of it, not being able to flush your toilets. We had a local supplier who, within about an hour, we asked him for porta potties. He delivered them to the library parking lot. And then we put this up on social media. Everyone poops. Don't take library books into the porta potty. Just because there are some apartment complexes, housing authority housing, a more densely populated area right around the library, so people could come here. And then as more things in the larger city got up and running, like Sam's opened just for water distribution. And so we had volunteers go pick up bottled water and then distribute through the library. And so one of the things we learned when communication methods were down was Code Red was a way about 3 or 4 days in that the city and county started getting messages out to people in the community. I have since learned that Code Red considers a good rate of adoption for their service to be about 15%, which leaves a lot of people out of that method of communication. That's one thing libraries can do, is help people sign up for Code Red because some people are unsure about how to do it. So again, it's just information and awareness. The next slide is just to show again that a TV station provided coverage. And just strategically, that's always good for us as a library because we're constantly battling against the stereotype of what kinds of services a library offers. And it's important for us that people in the community know that we provide essential services. The next slide shows what after the event, when we started kind of debriefing what went on, there was a lot of negative feedback to local government that they couldn't see what our city government had been doing, some of it behind the scenes. And so there was a lot of praise for the library, but negative talk about the city, which was not what we wanted because we're a subdivision of the city. And so we wanted to take those lessons identified, lessons learned that Mike spoke of. We